in general. And we have several. To be exact, we have three. We have the New Hampshire Confession. Or is it only two?
Abstract of Principles in 339.
Oh, Abstract of Principles in 1859, and then finally the Statement of Baptist Faith of the Southern Baptist Confession. So we have three, is it? Three statements of faith. Now I thought, by way of a kind of prelude to this, to say something of how the Baptists fit into the picture. If you have, and I borrowed one copy myself, of the Free Church Movement, just to see where this thing fits in, because the theology will be more intelligible if we see where the church itself belongs. On page 5, under Free Church Movement, which began in 1520, which, as you see, is way back at the beginning of the Reformation era, on the continent were the Anabaptists, about whom we've heard a good deal already, whom we've seen in another context in taking up the Mennonites. They were those who taught rebaptism on the score of evangelical continental Protestantism, compromising with Catholicism, not going all out, too ritualistic. A derivative, before the end of the next century, or the beginning, I should say, of the 17th century, were the Baptists, who are really an English product, who by that time had been affected by various nonconformists in England, from whom then derived a variety of American Baptist communions. The American Baptists, and the General Missionary Convention, from whom came what now is called the Southern Baptist Convention, formed in 1845. Just a word of qualification. The Southern Baptist Convention came into being partly because of the slavery question. This is 45 and it's before the Civil War. Nevertheless, slavery was already a live issue then. The Southern Baptists separated from what became various types of Northern Baptist groups over the slavery question. Over the years, the Southern Baptists have remained very conservative. As regarding the Baptists themselves, they are called Baptists, as the name implies, because somehow they have to do with baptism. Now you find among their less scholarly writers a claim that St. John the Baptist founded the Baptists. You only realize what they're saying, they wouldn't be proud of it, because they should want Christ to come and at least Christ. But that's unscholarly. The more scholarly of their writers, and by the way, the outstanding Baptist scholar in the United States, in fact, one of the great church historians of modern times, is Latourette. L-A-T-O-U-R-E-T-T-E, who has written a whole shelf of books in church history. He is extremely fair to all Christian churches, not excluding the Catholic. Actually, the Baptists, and we want to mention some of this so that you will get the savor of their theology, the Baptists, when they trace their origins, as they would want to say, to Christ himself, consider themselves, in a way, the traditional nonconformists of Christian history. Now, in the early centuries, and in fact up to the Reformation, and this is well to remember, a nonconformist was one who did not conform to, well, the only religion, Christian religion, that was around, namely the Catholic. So you had men like the Novatians, the Arians, the Albigenses, the Hussites, the Wycliffites. The Baptists, in all their histories, identify themselves with these nonconformists. They therefore find, as a kind of common theme in their theology, resistance to usurped authority. That's their badge of merit, as they say, and the hallmark of their genius. Their founder, so their scholars, men like Latourette say, was a man by the name of John Smiley of Cambridge, who died in 1612. He was an Anglican who was so nonconformist he had to flee England for his life. He went to Holland, found kindred spirits there among the Anabaptists, came back, founded three sects, from whom all Baptists have since been derived. Their names are pretty much passé now, but they are significant as descriptive of their thinking. They were the General Baptists, who claim that there is general redemption for all, and you'll see that as we take the Southern Baptists, which, as you see, is a departure from Calvinist teaching. Second, particular Baptists, who, by contrast, believe that only particular individuals, notice, not only will be saved, which all Christians claim, but are savable. That's different, isn't it? No Christian who believes in hell believes that everybody will go to heaven. Otherwise, why to hell? Except as a metaphor. Then, there were the so-called immersion Baptists, who claim that for valid baptism, you must be baptized by immersion. In fact, it is the teaching of Jesus himself. The Southern Baptists span, in a way, the general and the immersion Baptists of way back 16th century times.
You said you must be saved by immersion. That's just their teaching?
Yes, their teaching. Bahia is nominally associated with the Quakers, and other states are associated with Congregationalism, and especially with Anglicanism. So Rhode Island is commonly, or should be commonly, associated with the Baptists. Who founded Rhode Island, you historians? Please? Roger Williams. Roger Williams, founder of Rhode Island, and in fact built the first Baptist church at Providence. I didn't completely, what verb shall we use, baptize, make Baptist the state. Nevertheless, Rhode Island has been traditionally identified with historic Baptist religion. Now, while we're going to take only the Southern Baptist Convention, it's the largest and in many ways the most representative. In the United States, there are 27 Baptist denominations. Behind all their creeds, and each one has its own creed, not excluding the one we're going to examine, which is a 1957, I think, is it? Probably. Case 25. At least a 20th century product. But behind them stand two other creeds. A 1688, which we don't have, I don't think we have it in our book, a Baptist creed of 1688, which is straight Calvinism. And the New Hampshire creed, which I think we have, don't we? Which is less Calvinistic, more popular, and Arminian in its scope for theology. Notice the I. Arminian, which is not Calvinistic, does not teach selective predestination. Among the outstanding, in fact, most outstanding members of either the Baptist or the Southern Baptist Convention is Billy Graham, the preacher and revivalist. And if you follow Billy and his, say, radio addresses or otherwise, you will get in general the conservatism of his theology and also the depth of his faith. I'd like to give you a few figures so you can put the Southern Baptists into context. The Southern Baptists, by the latest that I've got, 1963, had an inclusive membership of 9,980,000, which is by all odds the largest Baptist church in the country. 33,000 churches, a total of 7.5 million children under Sunday school instruction, which is both a tribute to the size of the families. Mind you, ladies and gentlemen, with a total membership of less than 10 million, there are 7.5 million children. That's a lot of children. And secondly, it's a tribute to their zeal, to want to instruct their children. They have a clergy membership of about 30,000. And just the periodicals, this one line here does not exhaust the national periodicals of the Southern Baptist Convention. They are great writers. I would like to, again, before we get into their theology, something about all the things which they do. Take, for example, on the money which they give. The Southern Baptists are among the most generous of all church givers. Now, remembering how big they are, that's 10 million. I have in sequence here, by the way, the principal contributors among Protestant bodies in the United States. And these are as accurate as their financial reports can make them, see? The Baptists are tops for church contribution. This will help to at least savor the theology we're going to make. They are very generous. This is based on per membership contribution. Now, the North American General Conference, which is relatively small, has a per membership contribution for the year of $116.05. But the Southern Convention, with its almost 10 million membership, and mind you, this is on a 10 million membership basis, their total contribution was, for the year, $480 million. That's a lot of money, ladies and gentlemen, which is per member contribution $55.68 per year. To give you some idea of the impact of any denomination which will contribute $500 million a year to the support of its churches. In other words, they take their theology seriously. And their mission contribution is fabulous.
Do you know
what Captain Craig? I don't have it here. That's part of the secrecy, I suppose.
No, they're available. They're not in this book, though.
Father, is this money largely expended in mission?
Notice first a few items. Statement of Baptist faith and message, indicating that it is not exactly a confession of faith, which Baptists forbear doing. We do not call this a creed, it is a statement. At most, it could be called a confession. They prefer even statement. Secondly, the term Southern Baptist Convention is significant. Convention by itself merely means a coming together. They do not even call themselves technically a denomination or a church. They never say Southern Baptist Church. There is none. The idea being that these people just get together and have some kind of covenant agreement, not forming some kind of authoritarian society. And Southern Baptists, because they pretty much in the South over the slavery question were those who favored the holding of slaves. In general, the ancestors of the modern Southern Baptists were the slaveholders of the 19th century. That in general is the picture. Now the creed. Notice how informal this whole thing is. First it begins by statement of Baptist faith. Then report of committee on Baptist faith. It has none of the formality that we found in other creeds, where it begins with a preamble appealing to the Trinity and declaring this is the faith we believe this and we believe that. None of that. There is, of course, a profession of faith, but it is merely, as more than one item will indicate, a consensus of opinion and not an imposition. In the introduction, they state why they revised the creed, or if you will, why they formulated a new confession of faith. Notice the basis is the New Hampshire Confession, which we skipped, which, however, when I buy, or if I use for my own work, Baptist Confessions of Faith, I regularly buy a collection put out by the Judson Press, and it's the New Hampshire Creed. The book that I bought had already sold something like 120,000 copies. Baptists in general, therefore, follow the New Hampshire Creed. The Southern Baptists somewhat refined it, or redefined it, and this is the redefinition. Why? Was it because there was something wrong with the New Hampshire Creed? No. There was something wrong with the times, and they wanted to put into and explicitate, as it were, certain facets which are only implicit in the New Hampshire Creed, and this is typical of many Protestant churches. When they revise creeds, it is not necessarily that they come on a new doctrine, but rather the new times have arisen, new issues, for which the old creed had not even made provision, or perhaps it is too implicit, or maybe not even expressed. Now, what was their main concern? Their main concern, as expressed in the second to the last paragraph on page 344, was the prevalence of naturalism in the modern teaching and preaching of religion, and being said, be it said, in the modern teaching and preaching of the Baptist religion. They weren't concerned about preserving the Lutheran or the Episcopalians or the Catholics from naturalism. They wanted to protect Baptists, indeed their own Southern Baptists.
Excuse me, Father, is this where this controversy about Darwin came in Tennessee?
Indeed. In fact, do you know the dates of the Scopes trial?
27, is it?
It's in the early 20s, mid-20s. It's exactly at that time. Anyhow, however, the Scopes trial, although it is symbolic, would be only part of a larger concern, which really had more deeper meaning than evolution. And surprisingly, this is, you'll have to read a lot of Protestant creeds to find the word supernatural. There it is. In the second last paragraph on that page, Christianity is supernatural in its origin and history. To which, of course, many Christians could subscribe wholeheartedly. And then, we repudiate every theory of religion which denies the supernatural elements in our faith. And again, it does say, most Christians would say, bravo. By the way, there is a certain intransigence about the Baptists. They tend to call a spade a spade. In fact, they sometimes call it something else. So they're clear, usually, and they're not afraid to express themselves. Now, before we leave this, there's still in the following paragraph an explanation of why have creeds at all. Why bother drawing up a statement? And they say it clarifies the atmosphere, removes causes of misunderstanding, friction, and apprehension. So, in other words, it tends to clarify the position, know where you are, and removes misunderstanding as to where the Baptists stand on a particular position. The point is, they have a position. As anyone who is not a Baptist soon finds out. Now, their faith is first summarized in five statements. We'll go over these five in a little more detail, then pick up a number, not all, but a number of more explicit and detailed amplifications. First, what function or purpose, or what shall I say, what role, what authority does this creed have? So, These confessions, notice they use the plural anticipating many, they constitute a consensus of opinion, and frankly, that's all. What are they? A statement of agreement. Now, behind that statement of agreement, of course, is the implication that God approves that statement. Nevertheless, as such, it has no authority. Second, and not surprisingly, they are revisable. We do not regard them as complete statements of our faith, having any quality of finality or, shades of the Pope, infallibility. So they are reversible, revisable. And the revisability, by the way, the theologians, when they come to explain, is explained by saying that, well, people get new insights, new understandings, so you revise the creed. Words? They correctly, let's finish this first place. They correctly state that not just they, but all Baptists, large or small, have the inherent right to draw for themselves and publish to the world their confession of faith. So they are just, as they said, taking stock of or putting into practice a common Baptist prerogative. And in fact, the differences between one denomination, at least such as it is called, and another among the Baptists, is some different emphasis in the faith. Fourthly, and understandably, the Scriptures, Old and New Testament, are the only authoritative source of faith. So this is a restatement of what we've seen time and again in all the creeds of Protestantism. And confessions then would be only interpretations of that faith. Finally, and surprisingly, they are statements of religious conviction, there's the word, the operative word, drawn from the Scriptures, and they are not to hamper freedom of thought in other non-religious fields. No doubt, not excluding, for example, a thing like scientific evolution. Nevertheless, while that is not explicited, and the Southern Baptist Convention, I think, as such, at that time at least, would have rejected evolution. Still, you see, there is an open door here, which is a little surprising in an ultra-conservative body like the Baptists. Some of their statements of faith now. As you may notice, what I want to do in the course, and this is my purpose, I think we're finishing the third week, unless I'm mistaken, today, correct? And we are just about finished with the basic creeds. We'll have the Methodists yet. But by and large, we will have finished the major creeds of Protestantism. And I wanted to spend much, if not most, of the 3 weeks left us in the development, you see, in modern times, the ecumenical movement and the theology that is implicit therein. So we will not recapitulate things we've seen before. We'll just stress those that are special features. As regarding God, it is significant that while professing in belief in the Trinity, the statement is a little less than perfectly clear. God and so on, whom we owe the highest love, reverence, and obedience, he is revealed to us as no. He is that. But that, Arius said, Nestorius, they all taught that. As though, God's Trinity were our understanding, the way we see God, under three different formalities, three different aspects. And the reason is because, while the Southern Baptists are conservative in many ways, there is a great deal of freedom on dogma, not excluding the Trinity. In other words, not all Southern Baptists believe in the Trinity. And no doubt, beyond the formulation of this, this is a curious formulation if you know anything about Protestant thought. You don't find this, for example, in the Westminster Confession. Now the fall of man looks pretty complete. Man was created by the special act of God. Then he was created in a state of holiness under the law of his Maker, but through the temptation, whereby fell from his original holiness and righteousness. His posterity inherit a nature. So they do believe in inherited original sin, which is corrupted in bondage to sin. Now, that nature, even when we come to justification, is not too clearly reformed in the sense of regenerated intrinsically, although it is closer to that than, say, the Reformed creeds. How are you saved? The way of salvation. Standard, typical Calvinist theory. The salvation of sinners is wholly of grace. In other words, the element of freedom and the correlatives that we've seen, especially with the Quakers, would not stand ground with the Southern Baptists. Now, justification, by the way, one good reason for, this is the first very modern creed we are seeing, notice? This is the first, isn't that right? I think the first 20th century creed we're examining. And you'll see how there has been a little budging of hardcore Reformed teaching, because there is a Calvinism which stands behind, as you know, the Baptist Church. The last sentence in the paragraph number 5, it, that is justification, brings us into a state of most blessed peace, which is internal, and favor with God, which is external, and secures every other needed blessing. In other words, favor with God, not necessarily the infusion of grace. Now, under regeneration is a surprising statement. While the new birth is a change of heart wrought by the Holy Spirit, whereby we become partakers of the divine nature and a holy disposition is given. Nevertheless, even there, if you read commentaries, it is not what Catholics would believe by the infusion of grace, the possession of, say, the gifts of the Holy Spirit, in such a way that the person thereby is cleansed from sin, and because he has a free will, can merit. You do not find sanctifying grace or merit in the Baptist Creed, even though the language makes us suggest it. Now, under sanctification, number 10, remember, this is modern times now. It is heartening to see, and it is fairly typical of many modern religions in the Protestant tradition, that they believe there is a stage beyond just bare justification. It is the work of the Holy Spirit alone, nevertheless. You don't just get out of the dead level of your sin. You can become holy or holier. All the work of grace. A kind of progressive justification, which is called sanctification. In fact, they say it continues to the whole of life. And one reason, by the way, I should put this in, Wesley was the one who injected this into the Protestant tradition. And by this time, of course, you've got all the churches mutually affecting one another. His problem was a very simple one. If you hold to justification being a gradual process only in one sense, you stifle all virtuous effort. Suppose a sinner, before justification, is, of course, in the state of sin where his sins are both on his soul and imputed to him. Then this same sinner, so first unjustified, and then justified, if this role that happened, and it is commonly agreed that that was a momentary thing, in other words, it occurred, and there it was, you got the Spirit, you got the visitation, you received the grace, whereby you accepted Christ as your Savior, whereby you were now entitled to heaven, and were no longer regarded as a sinner, although you still were. If this were the end product, see, well, all right, so I'm justified, and I've got 30 more or 40 more years to go. Where did we go from here? Well, Wesley noticed that immediately. He just takes the wind out of all religion. And consequently, Wesley conceived the idea, which is an old conception, it's been in the church for centuries, that once justified, a person can become more justified still. Now, without admitting, which Protestantism in the classic form would not admit, that there was any free cooperation on the part of man's will towards the process, still remaining a sinner. See, this could be a gradual process up to this point. But suppose you reached it, then what? Then, so Wesley held, in general the Methodist tradition, and here the Southern Baptists declare the same, this is an ongoing process. And this is sanctification. Yes?
Do we have to say that this statement of faith is saying that justification and sanctification are synonymous?
They are synonymous? Or?
Do we have to say that they are? I can read this to say that justification was an act, period,
right.
And then sanctification is the process.
The process, which process?
Of the person becoming holy.
Well, now, just a moment. Becoming holy after he's justified or before he's justified?
After he's justified.
Okay, all right.
But then don't say sanctification and being more justified are synonymous terms.
Well, let's examine. What in your language would justification mean?
This in my language would be a declaratory act of God, period.
All right. Now, the declaratory act of God by which a man remains a sinner but is regarded
declared
as a
declared righteous.
Righteous, okay. Now,
declared, this would be a key word.
Okay. Now, say having been justified now and the process of sanctification begins, all right? What happens when the person becomes or is becoming sanctified? What more than he had before?
Well, academically and now psychologically, I don't know how this happens, but academically now, let me put regeneration between the two.
Well, I mean regeneration, but what happens to the person? Does he remain a sinner or does he cease to be a sinner?
Even while he is being sanctified?
Being sanctified.
Just as you stated there.
He remains a sinner. All right, so in other words, there's no basic change in him. There's no question of his possessing grace, as a Catholic would say.
Oh, I don't think he's becoming more Christ-like.
All right.
He should be a little better today than he was yesterday.
All right, but is it a functional thing or is it an ontological thing? In other words, is he acting more holily, which is really what this says, see? God's grace is glorifying God more and more by this person's showing himself holier and holier day by day.
He better show.
Okay, all right. But the whole the whole process, however, is God sanctifying this person through his grace, huh? As far as the man's entrails, so to speak, his spiritual entrails go, they're just as sinful as ever before.
That shouldn't be.
Well, of course, I don't think it is, personally, but I'm trying to put myself into a Protestant context.
Just hypothetically, you know, take a person who was as bad as he could be on the outside, as we could say, as you and I would see him, a drag on society, and he experienced the regeneration,
all right,
of which this creed speaks. Well,
and when he experienced,
it was a real thing. He's not going to be what he was before.
He's not going to be, no, because now he will begin performing acts of virtue which he never performed before.
Right.
But now, when we say that he performs those acts of virtue, is it he somehow cooperating with grace, or is it just plain grace using him as a kind of an instrument and thereby glorifying God?
Well, he's doing it.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's... Of course I agree. Of course I agree.
I'm not saying that he was and is motivated innately to do that.
No,
personally, I'd have to confess that I am constantly being prompted and prodded along a path which maybe my own natural inclinations might not direct me, even though I believe I have been justified and regenerated.
Yes, of course, your natural inclinations now are sublimated by grace, so it's not just natural inclinations. Well, all right. If you hold that, which I would hardly subscribe to, namely, that once a person is justified and, say, thereby regenerated, so that regeneration really means something more than it says here, because while it implies or allows more, it doesn't say more, that the person is no longer a sinner, and he then begins to act, and his actions are really his own, vital acts in which he cooperates with grace, fine. And if he becomes holier, not just his actions. But classic Protestantism would not allow that. See, classic Protestantism, of course, doesn't have a stage... classic Protestant. This is the edge of classic Protestantism.
Then I have misunderstood classic Protestantism.
If you find any sanctification in the Confession of Augsburg, or say in Calvin, you're going somewhere.
I have misunderstood Calvin.
The ability of going beyond, in other words, of improving oneself, of going beyond, that in fact was one of the basic issues of Wesley. Even with the Anglican, and you would expect the Anglicans of all people, see, to allow for sanctification. And there have been quite a few derivatives from the Methodists who broke away from the Wesleyan tradition because they say they have not been sufficiently insisting on this sanctification. The whole holiness movement, all the holiness churches, the Pentecostal movements, they get sometimes rather bizarre in their exploits. But the basic theology is one that is typical of Wesley and is quite untypical of those who preceded him.
Calvin is not my first authoritative source, but may I read him again?
Sure.
See, maybe I am wrong. Yes, maybe I've misunderstood him.
Well, just so. Of course, Al Calvin hasn't said the last word, as you know.
He's not my authority, finally.
No. Please not.
The script, sola scriptura.
Father, may I ask then, are they giving the individual a role in the sanctification?
Are they
giving
the
individual a role in the sanctification? In other words,
free will
is entering into the picture here?
Or
am I?
Hardly.
Yes.
Hardly.
Because
in other words, it is not clear, see, because the emphasis prior to this had been on the complete fall of man. The salvation of souls is wholly of grace. But when you've got an adverb like wholly of grace, salvation, notice, not really justification. See? Salvation is the terminus of justification, isn't it? Is that where justification is supposed to lead? But once you say wholly of grace, then it's pretty hard to put in an authentic freedom. But there is an ambivalence. In other words, it isn't too clear, yes?
I was wondering, Father, because then they use the word use, and it's accomplished by the use, rather.
All right. But the question is whether it is use in an intrinsic, free sense, or whether I use my will. For example, Calvin, even he would deny that we use our will.
But it's a redirected one.
Yes.
Redirected one.
Yeah. And I'm not the one who is ultimately responsible for the direction of that will.
We could use an example right here. You're directing us pretty well.
Thanks.
It's an analogy now. You may have accused Mike of trying to steer, but you've got us pretty well in hand. You know where we're going to be at on the 30. You're directing our wills in a sense.
Yes, of course. There's a difference, I'm sure you would admit, between Calvin's concept of direction of the human will by God and, say, mine.
On different levels.
Not many different levels. But you are still free agents. whatever you do.
Every analogy will break down somewhere.
Or this is a fundamental one, because here's the whole question of whether or not you are free while learning.
In the context of the situation I am in right now as a student in this classroom, I'm not free.
Well, you're not free. Once you decide to sit here, you are not free to be elsewhere. But you can decide to turn off the valve of your mind and resist everything that I say. And I wouldn't, you would smile, you would look so very offended.
A person could do this respectfully.
Right. So you have quite complete control.
And yet, you're going to get me where you want me by the end of this course.
Thanks for the compliment.
Number 11, perseverance. All real believers endure to the end. Their continuous well-being is the mark which distinguishes them from mere professors. Now, the word there is real believers. And you constantly find it in the Baptist literature, one who really believes, who is really justified, who has been really regenerated. In other words, distinguishing between the pseudo and the real. In other words, a member of the Baptist church may not be a real believer. And they say that a special providence for those people, see, that they will persevere. The assumption being that if you are a real believer, you are saved. Now, unexpectedly, a Church of Christ is called a congregation of baptized believers, and therein lies the essence of the Baptist churches, and the Southern Baptist in particular. On their structural level, they are congregations. They are so congregational that everything about them is geared to remove every vestige or suspicion of their being dominated by any kind of authority. First of all, they are not even called a church or a denomination. They are called a mere convention. Their meetings would, of course, be assemblies or convention itself, and they don't even call the people whom they send from the churches delegates. They have coined the word messengers. They eschew any semblance of authority. Now, this is well worth reading. Let's read the paragraph. A church of God, notice the small c on church, of baptized believers, as we'll see in a moment, you've got to be baptized as a believer, associated by covenants, in other words, by agreements, in the faith and fellowship of the gospel. Now, faith means belief, and fellowship means practice, basically. As you probably know, if you don't know, allow me to tell you, the most common, familiar, and distinctive Protestant term in the whole Protestant vocabulary is the word fellowship. And it has a lot of meanings. It comes from the Greek idea of a community, koinonia. In fact, the New Testament, usually, you may check your Bible, usually translates, when you find community in the New Testament, say in the Acts, the word fellowship will be used. Basically, it means an agreement in matters of external conduct and ritual. Agreement. The faith, therefore, would be the internal agreement, the covenant. Covenant is the generic term. In what do you covenant? On what do you agree? To believe and to practice fellowship, meaning to cooperate. And when you don't want to, you just form another church. Observing the ordinances of Christ, governed by his law, exercising the gifts, rights, and privileges invested in them by his word, is Christ, and seeking to extend the gospel to the ends of the earth. Its scriptural officers are bishops or elders and deacons. Now, when they mention those, and they do, bishops, notice how quickly they drop the bishop to an elder. Now, you take in the Presbyterian tradition, in fact, in most traditions, Protestant, the elder is hardly one of the superintendents or leaders of the church, see? Suggesting that even when they have what corresponds, they don't use, in the United States, by the way, they don't have bishops. There are no Southern Baptist bishops. But the word bishop, you see, has a curious connotation for anybody who would not be a Baptist. It would be someone who is over this congregation. And he can be indiscriminately called, and is called, either bishop, seldom, or elder, or deacon, or simply pastor.
Isn't the point here that what they really want to say is that one single minister isn't the ruler of a church, of a congregation?
Right.
This is what they're trying to say.
That's right. The congregation runs itself while allowing for someone to more or less function as the delegate for the group.
Bishop or elder, the two terms are synonymous.
Synonymous, correct. He does not have what we usually associate with a bishop. Priestly orders, apostolic succession like in Episcopalianism, none of that.
But it's plural. This is the point I'm trying to get at.
Oh yes, bishops.
One
Good, very good, bishops. Yep. Because there are as many, really, as there are congregations.
But within one congregation, though, because you remember what you said, small c, a church,
yes,
will have bishops. This
yes.
is the point.
Yes.
A church, a congregation will have bishops.
Well,
this
not, I would say that could be. They would. That would be a very honorific, a very heavy term to use. See? They might have elders.
Well, the terms are synonymous.
Yes.
Use either one.
But I must say, in my own reading, I have not found... They usually avoid the word bishop.
I happen to be an elder in a church. Mm-hmm. If you want to call me a bishop, it's okay.
Yes.
It's a good scriptural term.
Yes.
I think the term elder is just a more modern...
Read the first chapter of 1 Timothy, of both of you.
Much. That paragraph almost describes to you the thinking of most American churches, because the majority are of some kind of congregational polity. The number, even in the Reformed and Lutheran tradition, in the United States, for example, we have no Lutheran bishops, as they do have in Germany, and much less still, say, in the Reformed tradition. Now, baptism and the Lord's Supper. The short paragraph there is misleading because, after all, these people are Baptists, so baptism must loom large in their thinking. First, regarding baptism, is the immersion. They define it by the function. Baptism is the immersion of a believer in water in the name of the Father, of the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Without the immersion, there is no baptism according to the Southern Baptists. They therefore go back to the old Anabaptists, who both rebaptize infants, or people who have been baptized in infancy, and immerse them. What is their argument? A very simple, literal one. Baptize in the Greek means immersion. Does it? It does. And consequently, if Christ said, going therefore baptize all nations, we're supposed to go out and baptize, which means immerse. Well, now, is there any out? Are they right then? I have a book in my room, my office, which examines all kinds of dictionaries and Greek lexicons and so on to prove that baptize means nothing less than complete bodily immersion. Those who don't go along with it, and by the way, not a few Baptists, see, in the north, do not immerse. They argue from the fact that, sure, the word etymologically means immerse. But when the Christians adopted the Greek vocabulary, who would say they're going to be stuck with the Greek meaning? Otherwise, why have Christianity? Everything which Christianity touched, every Greek word in the New Testament, has been invested with new meanings, profound meanings. In terms of a function, therefore, if we go just to the Scriptures, and this, of course, is a case where if you go literally to the Scriptures, you end up with immersing everybody. And there's no way out. And if you don't, you're unscriptural. That's all there is to it. And I would defy anybody to challenge that. Pardon me. But we find from the first century already, and the document which I think I quoted to you, the Didache.
D-I-D-A-C-H-E.
Which says, when you baptize, you may use, and then they explain. It's a ritual manual. You may use, for some strange reason, either warm water or cold water. You may use still or running water. You may, if there is enough water, immerse. If there is not enough, you may pour. That document, universally recognized as authentic, is dated 94 A.D. It seems, not only from that, but from other evidences we have, that people were baptized where there was no question of immersion. But you've got to go outside of the Gospels or the New Testament itself to find warrant for that interpretation because, for example, the baptism in the Acts of the Apostles was by immersion, wasn't it? Christ himself, who prefigured the baptism which he instituted, was also by immersion. Nevertheless, though etymologically the word means immerse, it is, so it may be explained, symbolic for the idea of being immersed somehow. See, in the blood of Christ, or at least in being drowned or dead to the old man through sin and taking on the new man, as St. Paul explains, you don't need a physical immersion.
a Baptist, that I accept nobody who is not immersed bodily in baptism. But then, when it comes to the Eucharist, not only is there baptism by immersion, but the Eucharist itself is purely commemorative. In both cases, both baptism and Eucharist are, in the Baptist tradition, certainly for the Southern Baptists, pure symbolism. The act, speaking of baptism, is a symbol of our faith. And then the use of bread and wine commemorates. It is merely a memorial. Baptists are Zwinglians in their theology of the sacraments. And Zwinglians were symbolists, going way beyond Calvin. Luther was a realist. For him, real baptism, real effect, and the Eucharist, real body and blood. Calvin, spiritual change. And in the case of the Eucharist, you spiritually receive Christ. Zwingli, you don't receive anything. It is merely a symbol, an external sign or gesture of what? Of what God has done, which you are now somehow enacting. Please? Zwingli. Z-W-I-N-G-L-I. His first name is just as bad. Ulrich. U-L-R-I-C-H. Zwingli. He had been a priest, left the Catholic Church, became the most extreme of the early reformers.
The question I want to ask, you may have answered it when you talked about the didache?
Didache, yes.
The Roman Catholic position on the mode of baptism, have you stated it in there?
Yes. The ordinary mode of baptism in the Catholic Church is pouring of water. The child or the person has water poured over their head. Usually they don't stand up straight out. Water would go down, which would be perfectly valid. Would get you all wet. So they usually lean the head over the font, and the water is poured across the forehead to baptize them.
My point is, are they as specific on that as, say, these Baptists are on immersion? Is the mode...
The mode is crucial. So crucial, in fact. Were you there when I asked Dr. Pryor?
Yes.
And when he said he would put his hand into the water, and he said dripping. Well, by the time he got the hand up, see, it would be wet all right, but hardly dripping. I mean, water is not paint, right? Or oil. It drops. It has almost no viscosity. And consequently, by the time you reach it up, especially a wriggling child, by the time you're ready to baptize a child with your wet hand, that's all you do. You just put a wet hand on top of what I have found in baptizing a few babies. They have an awful lot of hair. Did you know that?
Then my point would be this.
And that, from the Catholic viewpoint, is invalid.
If we may tend to feel that the Baptists are being too literal here in requiring absolutely immersion, how can a Catholic justify?
Well, it isn't. Well, Mr. Seichel, it isn't whether a person is literal on something, it's what he is literal about. In other words, for example, to be literal about, whether or not I sign my first or second name when I make out, say, an affidavit, but whether I sign my name or not, or whether I forge my name, see? There are certain things which,
in
every law...
I mean, they took the word Baptist and transliterated it.
That's right.
It seems like this is behind their concept.
True, and I respect their literalness, see? But I say, well, if you're going to be literal, there are things about which you should be literal.
I don't know if you got me. Why would a Catholic say poor?
Well, because it had always so been done, so a Catholic believed. It had always been so done. And besides that, after all, the sacraments, so a Catholic believes, see, they're not merely symbols. They are signs of an effect. And by signs of an effect, there is something externally done which somehow signifies what internally takes place. Now, what is believed to internally take place in the case of baptism is an ablution of soul.
a cleansing, a washing of soul. Right? Now, if the sign is going to be significant, not really symbolic, it ought to somehow externally manifest that which God tied in with that sign. There must be some kind of a washing or its equivalent, which would be at least the pouring of water.
Then I'd say immersion might be better.
Well, in the early church, they did immerse.
Oh, yes, they did. Most people got immersed. Fine. They still do it. The Catholic Church still immerses. But not commonly, not generally. The Greek rites, Eastern and so on, they immerse. May come a day when, if immersion becomes popular, we may have it in all of the Catholic churches.
Could Catholic priests like yourself recognize a Baptist baptism when the thinking and theology behind baptism is only symbolic, where with you it is not? Would the Catholic Church recognize this as a valid baptism, even though
in general, yes. There have been a number of cases submitted to Rome on this subject, not specifically regarding the Baptists, but in cases of baptism where the people believe nothing about baptism that a Catholic believes, pure symbolism. And the usual answer from Rome was always that baptism stands. On the other hand, while saying that, see, there can be a lot of doubts arising, because take, for example, a person who does not believe in the Trinity. There is a real doubt theologically as to whether that baptism is valid. Because then the question arises of the seriousness of his baptizing, you see. After all, this is not magic. Somebody must have some faith behind it. You don't just pour water and pronounce words. Okay? This is not superstition. It's supposed to be some kind of influx of grace. So there is something, some minimum which has to be required. As far as the ritual goes, if, for example, the water is not poured, or if these words are not pronounced, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, then certainly it is not valid. Now, for example, as I may have mentioned, did I, in the Lutheran tradition, that the Lutheran, unexpectedly, the Lutherans of the Concordia, Southern, rather, Missouri Synod, in their seminary textbook, a moral theology textbook, which I have, they tell their ministers they may baptize either in the name of the Trinity or in the name of the Lord Jesus. If they would so baptize in the second way, in the Catholic Church, that is not valid baptism.
Does at least one have to be a believer?
For the Baptists, yes. In other words, behind the Baptists stands the twofold principle of both immersion and belief. Unless you already have the faith. If you get baptized, well, nothing happens. In a sense, nothing happens anyhow, because it's symbolic. Nevertheless, it is simply not recognized. The justification comes from faith, and the believer is baptized to, as it were, confirm or symbolize, signify what took place in him before the actual immersion.
The Catholic Church then, even if a person didn't believe, say, one believer just baptizes another believer with the right words, then the person baptized wouldn't get the grace until he believed. Is that right?
No. In other words, if you're asking, after all, there must be some kind of belief to have effective baptism. And if a person would not believe and rejected baptism, what I mean is rejected it internally.
Well,
just pouring the water.
I know the words, and I come up to someone and say, how'd you like to be baptized? He said, well, fine. I said, well, I baptized.
Well, does he want to be baptized?
Father, Son, Holy
does
Spirit.
He want to be baptized or not? Well, it all depends. If he doesn't want to, he cannot be. You do not baptize a person against his will. You may baptize a person independent of his will as a child, but never against.
Well, then will the child be baptized?
Sure.
I mean, would the child have been raised then, if a non-believer baptized?
Yes. Yeah. Of course, because behind the baptism of by the unbeliever, there must be an assumption. Why doesn't the unbeliever baptize?
Just to show that he knows the words.
Well, if he has no intention of baptizing, somebody must have the intention of baptizing.
At least, we have half a minute. Here is the baptizee. Okay? And here, say, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Number 10 does the actual baptism.
this person is an unbeliever. Now, provided the first person who started the line, say the mother told the nurse, the nurse told another nurse, the nurse told an orderly, the orderly told the doctor told, and you go on down the line. Provided there was somewhere in that line the element of faith in wanting to do what Christ wants done, number 10 is valid, even though everyone from 2 to 10 didn't believe in what they were doing. But in order to satisfy the one whom they were asked, who originally believed, that baptism is valid. But if nobody believed, no baptism. And it's just a ceremony, which we will briefly finish up, and don't forget the Methodists for next Monday, or also Dr. Emblem's lecture on Sunday, 7:15, and suicide. Remember, I asked you not to leave this room if possible. I hate to put it so bluntly. It's the subject of philosophy and philosophy of religion. You may have a little difficulty wrapping your minds around the concepts, but the basic idea is something having